Welcome once again to our series, The Da Vinci Code Deciphered. We're trying to point out in a reasonable and yet clear way the great misrepresentations that this popular book and less popular movie, and now a DVD, the version coming out, and even some games on video about the Da Vinci Code, what misrepresentations they do to Christianity and our traditional Christian and especially Catholic beliefs about God and Jesus and the Bible. So we're going to spend several times this session focusing individually on how the Da Vinci Code, just without basic historical facts of any kind, misrepresents the most fundamental truths of our faith. Once again, Ron Eldred, who teaches at John Paul II Catholic High, Religion, History, and Government, is our guest, and I'm Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus here at St. Patrick Catholic Church at 19th and Poplar, with the Shamrock intersecting the street. Ron, once again, welcome, and I think we could start out with a little reminder, a little summary of what are the main misrepresentations and just fundamentally incorrect facts that the Da Vinci Code takes as a matter of course in this novel that was so popular across the United States and even across the world.
Before I address this issue, I'd just like to make a comment. I've been watching the video release of the Da Vinci Code the last couple of evenings, and it just makes me that much more convinced that you can't let those kind of false, blatantly false charges go, you know, unanswered. Now, of course, there are people who have answered it in books and in seminars and radio programs, TV programs, and we draw, you know, a lot on some of their information.
Their great historic work.
Yes, but I'm just that much more convinced that we need to do this. It makes it awfully hard for me to watch Andy Griffith anymore. I liked that program so well to see how little Opie turned out, that he would actually direct a program that would be just so obviously anti-Catholic in particular and anti-Christian and in general.
Okay.
But to go on into to start answering your question there, there are several major issues that involve God and Jesus in the Bible that people such as Carl Olson and Sandra Meisel, whom we've mentioned several times in their book The Da Vinci Hoax, and also they've both written several articles on the subject too, they identify several major places or points where very anti-Catholic, very anti-Christian claims, and I'll name these right here. One of them, that Jesus Christ was not truly divine, but merely a good man, raised to a deity by the Emperor Constantine in 325 AD at the Council of Nicaea.
That may be one of the worst claims.
Yes, in fact, that was one that stands out in the video as I was watching it last night. The second one, Jesus Christ came not to save the world from sin, but to restore the sacred feminine. The third is Jesus Christ was married to Mary Magdalene and had children, at least had a daughter. Number three, or four, Jesus Christ appointed Mary Magdalene to head the Catholic Church instead of Peter.
That's another explosive blow.
Yes, and then fifth, the Catholic Church has kept these and other so-called facts hidden through force and intimidation over the centuries. So these are the five major criticisms that strike at, Catholic teachings, Catholic doctrines, and so we're going to focus our attention on refuting each of these five in the remaining portion of this series.
All right, I think it's a good summary, Ron, to pull all that together because people who have read the book maybe have never really realized that those five fundamental Catholic and Christian foundation stones are so contrary to the constant teaching of the Church and historical fact that the novel may have just made it seem plausible and presentable and, well, you know, maybe there's something to this. So we're going to take, let's take them one by one. Jesus Christ was not truly divine, but merely a good man raised to a deity by the Emperor Constantine in 325 at the Council of Nicaea. So what can we say about that?
Well, I'll answer this question first by taking a look at Constantine or Constantine. I've heard it pronounced both ways. And then we'll look at the Council of Nicaea, probably the next half-hour session. Brown tries to give the impression in the Da Vinci Code that Constantine or Constantine's main interest in Christianity was political and that he remained a pagan all of his life. In fact, I can just hear Lee Teabing last night in the movie, you know, making that very comment, the man that played Lee Teabing in the movie. Olson and Meisel in the Da Vinci Hoax, on the other hand, have identified several claims about Constantine made by Brown's puppet Teabing that I just mentioned there that are just simply misleading or false. And I'll list these. First, that Constantine was baptized on his deathbed against his wishes. Two, he was the head priest of the cult of Sol Invictus, or the Invincible Sun, for the official religion of Rome was the worship of a kind of a sun worship.
Okay.
Another claim made in the book, his sole purpose was to unify Rome by means of a single religion, that he was not really a believing Christian. In fact, Teabing last night made the comment that he was just a pagan, remained a pagan all of his life. He converted the pagans of Rome and the empire to Christianity by creating a hybrid religion that was a mixture of pagan symbols, dates, and rituals. And finally, he transformed Jesus from a mere mortal man to the Son of God, and thus cemented the Catholic Church's control of the person of Jesus Christ.
Okay.
Now, we won't be able to examine all of these assertions in lots of detail, but we'll look at some of them more than others.
All right, let's do first, who was Constantine, and what role did he play in the Da Vinci Code novel and book and movie and DVD?
Constantine was the Roman emperor from 306 to 337 A.D., but he didn't solidify his power until 312. Even though he had become the emperor 6 years before that. In 312, when he defeated a rival at the famous Battle of Milvian Bridge over the Tiber River near Rome, a little north of Rome. Eusebius of Caesarea reports in his Ecclesiastical History, that's a very famous history of the Catholic Church written in mid to 4th century, that Constantine later claimed that on the way to Rome with his army, he saw during the night before the battle, that is, the Battle of Milvian Bridge, a vision in the sky of the Cairo, which is the Greek symbol of Christ, shining above the sun. Other accounts say that it was a cross instead of the Cairo, but nonetheless, something. Apparently he saw something.
And this seems to be historical fact.
Yes. It is also reported that an inner voice told him that by this sign you will conquer. In Latin, we hear this sometimes. In hoc signo vincis. In this sign you will conquer. Well, whatever the vision he saw this as a divine sign, whatever the actual vision was. And it is said that he had his soldiers paint the cross of the Cairo, either the cross or the Cairo sign on their shields with white, some kind of white paint. In fact, I saw about a three-hour program on TV the other night. I think it was either the History Channel or one of the Discovery Channels. And it was really quite good, very historically accurate and very well done, where they painted their shields with the Cairo. They used actually the Cairo in this particular movie. Following this, Constantine went on to defeat the much larger army of his rival, a man by the name of Maxentius. And Constantine thought that this victory was directly related to the vision, and as a consequence concluded that the Christian God had helped him win the battle, and he came to see himself as the emperor of the Christian people. You have to keep in mind that he wasn't a Christian up to this time. He was a pagan. Now, it's debatable whether or not this made him a Christian, a full-fledged Christian at that time, but because, as Teabing points out in the Da Vinci Code, he wasn't baptized until his deathbed, but nonetheless, he's generally considered to be the first Christian emperor of the Roman world, of the Roman Empire. There was a reason a lot of times people waited until near their death to be baptized back in those days, and particularly for people who were in the military or people who were in some kinds of high governmental positions, because sometimes, at least they thought they had to do things that were not too Christian, and they thought that the best that they wait until they got toward the end of their life before they were, accepted into the church and baptized. Well, of course, they were taking a chance, and it was very risky to do that. Although I suppose a baptism of desire, these are people that perhaps would have certainly been considered undergoing a baptism of desire.
Wasn't that the process going on in Augustine's life until he actually was converted?
Yeah, one of the problems was some of the penalties were so harsh in the church. There were four or five things that if you committed, it was very difficult to get back into the good graces of the church. You might be forgiven, the priest might forgive you, but to be, to receive Holy Communion or maybe even be allowed into the canon of the Mass, that part of the Mass we call the consecration.
I think the three great sins of the early church were apostasy,
yes,
denying the faith, adultery,
yes,
and maybe murder.
Murder was another one.
Okay.
Yes.
And boy, you had to do penance for years and years before a person would be brought back again into the church.
And, sometimes people who was a top governmental official might get engaged in some things that were a little shady or maybe considered by the church immoral. And so if you were guilty of that kind of thing, it would be very difficult to be really a full-fledged practicing Catholic during that time. So that's why, again, some of them just simply waited until they were older to be baptized.
But no one questions that Constantine had some kind of vision, and he asked his soldiers to paint a certain Christian symbol on their crosses before the battle.
He thought he heard something,
and I don't know even any secular historian would question that.
No,
because it's always talked about in church history, or not in secular history, about the battle of the Milvian Bridge. Okay, well, isn't it true that Christians were persecuted very violently up until Constantine's time?
Yes. Before his reign, the practice of Christianity had been essentially illegal in the Roman Empire. And in fact, Christians had experienced a particularly vicious empire-wide persecution under the reign of Diocletian just a few years before Constantine came to power. And, of course, we all know about a couple of centuries before that, there was first Nero's persecution. That was the first great persecution in the Roman Empire. And then there were others that followed after that, certainly during the time of Antoninus Pius and the emperor and his son, Marcus Aurelius, terrible persecution during that time. Caligula wasn't too bad. But during the time of Diocletian, right before Constantine, that was one of the most severe persecutions of Christians.
And isn't that persecution under Nero, where we talk about that Nero had set a fire in Rome in order to get inspiration when he would play his music and write some kind of poetry, and that's where we get Nero fiddled while Rome burned.
Yeah, that's one of the stories. It's possible he wanted to build a new palace, and it's possible that he did have that part of the town burned, which was mostly made up of wooden structures that went up to like 6-8 stories high, where just the common people lived. So the word got out, rumor got out that he had purposely set it on fire so he could get rid of that whole area so he could build this new big palace that he eventually did build.
But also then he turned it against the Christians had done that.
Yeah.
They were a good scapegoat.
And so, yes, that was one of the...
He was one of the really crazy emperors.
Well, he did all kinds of silly things. For example, he fancied himself a great athlete. And they put on these big, games, these athletic games, and everybody always had to let him win.
Oh.
And then, of course, after that, he would get a laurel, like they used to put the Greek laurel on their heads, the olive laurel on their heads. And then also he fancied himself a great musician and poet, and he'd compose this music, and then he would sing it and, basically force people to come in and listen to him and praise him for his wonderful talents.
So really
had his own mother killed, too, so... Although she might have been sort of deserving of it, but she still was, a man would kill his own mother. That ought to tell you something about him.
Well, and isn't he the one, at least according to Sienkiewicz's a novel about Quo Vadis, that he actually had Christians tarred and burned as human torches in the gardens?
Well, they literally killed thousands of Christians in the circus. The Colosseum wasn't built yet, so... They didn't come until later under Vespasian. But nonetheless, there was lots of, literally thousands of Christians during that time were martyred.
Okay.
In the circus, the Roman circus, and elsewhere.
So at least we know that Constantine was the first Roman emperor who made Christianity legal.
Yes.
And he could come up out of the catacombs.
It's long been debated... why he elevated Christianity to the level of equality with the pagan religions. What we have to make clear is that he did not make Christianity the legal religion of the Roman Empire. He just simply, it was an act of toleration at Milan. It's called the Act of Toleration.
Which was a real breather.
Yes, it at least elevated Christianity to the point where it was legal. And the pagan, at least equal with the pagan religions that were then practiced in Rome at that time. One scholar has said, talking about his motives for becoming a Christian, was it because of a faint glimmer of real faith, or was it the presence of Christians in his own family, especially, of course, his mother, Saint Helena, or was it some mysterious political calculation to consolidate his empire? Or was it, a combination of all of these and perhaps some other motives as well? Human motives are usually mixed and complex, whatever the case, among Constantine's first actions was to issue an edict of toleration of Christianity in 313. Which ended persecutions for the moment, at least. There were a few times after that where the Christians were persecuted for a short period of time, at least in certain parts of the empire. But this is known as the Edict of Milan, which declared the Roman Empire at least neutral with regard to religious worship, officially ending all of the government-sanctioned persecution, especially of Christians.
All right, so you're suggesting or saying that perhaps a few persecutions continued after that, but that was really the death knell of the official persecution by the government.
Yeah, there was a short period in the period of Justinian. There was a short period during Julian the Apostate and things like that, but not anything really terrible, nothing like what had been before.
Okay. All right. Constantine apparently did convene the Council of Nicaea in 325. Why did he do that?
Carl Olson and Sandra Meisel in the Da Vinci Hoax, they identify four claims that Brown makes in the Da Vinci Code about the Council of Nicaea. that are either misleading or blatantly false. And I'll name these. We won't be able to look at all of them in detail, but one of them was that the divinity of Christ was first raised and established at the Council of Nicaea in AD 325. Number two, prior to that time, no one, not even Jesus' followers, believed Jesus was anything more than a mortal prophet, a great man. Yet no one believed that Jesus was the Son of God until that momentous event, that is.
At the Council of Nicaea, 325.
Yes. Three, this belief was proposed and voted into existence by a relatively close vote at the Council of Nicaea, endorsed by Emperor Constantine for the purpose of solidifying his power and the power of the new Vatican power base of the Catholic Church.
Now that's a false claim,
yes,
of the Da Vinci Code novel.
And then four, this meant that those claiming to be Christian could redeem themselves only through the established sacred channel of the Catholic Church.
Okay, let's take those on. There are some these are obviously devastating claims if there's any truth in them. So what is the truth of the matter?
According to Dan Brown in the Da Vinci Code, Constantine, or Constantine, Roman emperor during the early 4th century, was the founder of Christianity as we know it today. Through Lee Teabing, his mouthpiece, one of his mouthpieces in the novel, we learn that before Constantine, Jesus was venerated simply as a wise teacher or a sage, maybe even a prophet, but then he was just simply, you know, merely human. He goes on to lecture Langdon and Sophie that when Constantine came to power, he was distressed by the conflicts between Christianity and paganism because they threatened to divide his empire. So the best way to solidify his power was to promote this merely mortal teacher and prophet, Jesus Christ, to the divine Son of God. And in order to do this, he selected Christianity to be the official religion of his empire. And in 325, he called hundreds of bishops to attend an ecumenical council at Nicaea, where, according to Dan Brown, they were forced to affirm that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. What he is saying, of course, is that Jesus was considered to be a mere man until the bishops at Nicaea elevated him to the Godhead.
Okay, so such a false claim we need to talk about a little bit.
Well, any John Paul II Catholic High student to whom I teach history and religion knows that that this is absurd. No reputable historian would support this view. The evidence from Christian sources such as the New Testament and the early church fathers and contemporary secular sources during the period as well overwhelmingly support the view that Christians believe at the very beginning, from the very beginning, that Jesus Christ is God and man, and man, God and man. The so-called Gnostic Gospels that Dan Brown and his sources rely so heavily on for his facts, they might not embrace the teaching that Jesus Christ is Lord, but the inspired canonical New Testament is full proof for this belief. And we examine some of the proof texts that support this view during our series on understanding the Nicene Creed, and we'll take a look at a few of these now.
All right, fine. So we said that the Gnostic Gospels are these unauthenticated Gospels that the Church never accepted, are the ones that Dan Brown is using as his primary source.
Yes, we'll take a couple half-hour sessions and explain what these Gnostic Gospels are.
All right, let's clarify, what does the New Testament say about Jesus being God, which is a powerful, powerful mystery of our faith?
Brown's claims questioning Jesus' divinity are simply more claims among his many misunderstandings or falsifications of the facts of history. The truth of the matter is that before the Council of Nicaea, the Catholic Church had taught that Jesus Christ is God from the very beginning. Many places in the New Testament make reference to Jesus being the Son of God. There are at least a dozen places in the Gospels where Jesus himself claims to be God, God's Son. He was so clear in this matter that at least two times the Jewish leaders sought to stone him to death because they were certain that he was claiming to be on a par with God. And, of course, stoning to death was the Jewish punishment for blasphemy.
One of the statements was, before Abraham was, I am.
Yes.
That words from the the book that the burning bush has spoken to Moses.
That's how Jesus identified, or God himself identified himself to Moses. And then, of course, the scribes and Pharisees, the chief priests, reached down to get stones to stone him because they knew what he was claiming.
Okay.
And we must not forget that the real reason he was crucified for it was for blasphemy.
Claiming to be God.
Claiming to be God.
Okay.
Moreover, the Acts of the Apostles, as well as St. Paul's letters, tells us that Jesus is Lord and God in many places. Mark Shea and Edward Shea, both of them noted scripture scholars, say in the Da Vinci Deception, their Da Vinci Deception, that, quote, Paul's letters alone refer to Jesus as the Son of God 17 times, and that the New Testament is, as a whole refers to him as God's Son more than 100 times. Also, the Gospels relate stories describing the virginal conception by the Holy Spirit. You need to see Matthew the first couple of chapters in Matthew and the first couple of chapters in Luke for that. The accounts of Jesus' baptism, when the Father identified Jesus as his beloved Son, with whom he is well pleased, and the Transfiguration, I might add, where the Father again refers to Jesus as his beloved Son and to listen to him. And the Gospels describe how Jesus forgave sins, how he lived a life of holiness and perfect virtue, how he demonstrated superhuman knowledge and wisdom, how he changed or modified God's laws in some places, how he performed great miracles, and how he successfully prophesied the future, and above all, how he rose from the dead under his own power. All things that only God can do. Not once does Brown refer to the New Testament for his facts about Jesus. Not once. But instead relies on heretical writings that were written much later by people who denied Jesus' divinity. And I'm referring there, of course, to the Gnostic Gospels, which I said a while ago, we'll spend a couple half-hour sessions explaining what those are. If one wants to learn about Jesus, and you know, don't read the Gospel according to Dan Brown or any of his sources that he relies upon. We listed five or six books that he relied very heavily on, such as Elaine Pigalle's The Gnostic Gospels and Margaret Starbird, The Alabaster Jar, and Lee, and some of those people, the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail, books like that. But read the Gospels themselves if you want to find out, to answer questions like whether or not Jesus claimed to be divine or not.
So there's not any question, if a person will read the New Testament, the Gospels, and the letters of Paul, that Jesus very clearly is called God. Thomas calls him my Lord and my God. And that's one of the fundamentals of the Catholic faith. Well, I think, Ron, this is a good place that we can break off. And may God bless you always and in all ways. Hoping to be with you next time again.
Oh,